All right. Well, we're a small group, which is actually really good for this. So I'm excited. We're going to talk at you on a microphone, not because we think we need them, but because we're recording this session so folks can watch it later. So otherwise, I would just come down and sit with you. But we'll do this to make sure we capture for posterity. So you'll notice there's some folks on the slide up there that are not here. Heather Sanborn was our third member. Heather got COVID, and so she and her family are at home. Mild symptoms, they'll be just fine, but out of an abundance of caution and not wishing to spread COVID, Heather is not with us today, but obviously with us in spirit. So I'll talk a little bit just about, you know, how this project presentation came together, and then I'm going to ask Roxanne to introduce herself, and then we'll dig in. So this presentation is a continuation, as I mentioned in the other room. It's about equity scorecards. And very briefly, an equity scorecard is essentially a report card for your organization to communicate and keep track of how it's doing on key performance indicators related to equity and inclusion. Was it 2019, Roxanne?
Yeah, that's when we started.
Is that when we started?
Yeah, I think that's when we started the effort
In the committee.
In the committee, too.
Yeah. So in 2019, the BRSA Association Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee, which at the time was just probably about 7 or 8 people, decided that we wanted to institute an equity scorecard for the Brewers Association. This was an ambitious idea at the time because there was no internal DEI function at the Brewers Association at the time. I was a part-time contractor, and the committee basically was the BA's DEI work. So we had been doing everything kind of outward-facing at that point, and it was our first effort to really say, like, well, the organization itself needs to know how it's doing with regard to that process. So Roxanne, myself, Heather, and I think Andrea Stanley, who's she's presenting at the conference from Valley Malt. She's no longer on the committee. And maybe one other person. Yeah. Sorry, that person. We formed a task force to talk about, you know, what types of things we wanted to measure within the BA so that we can know how the organization was performing. That took a long time. We were doing that for months, and it's a challenging process. We presented our ideas like, hey, Brewers Association, we would like you to keep track and measure these various things. We got input from the BA staff, a couple rounds of backs and forths. And then at the conclusion of that process is about when I came on to the Brewers Association full time. And so the equity scorecard has been one of my major projects since I joined the BA. We have a big one. So that's not what we're going to talk about today because we have a big organization and we're trying to hold ourselves to a lot of standards. But we decided that as we were developing the BRSA Association Equity Scorecard, we would also just open the doors to that process so that anyone out there, any organizations out there who want to do the same thing would kind of have an insight into what we're doing. So Heather, Roxanne, and I presented last year in September at CBC. That presentation was really about defining like what equity scorecards are and how they're used, what sorts of stuff might appear on one. Today, we're going to actually just get like way more into the weeds and say, you know, look at like, what is a scorecard? What could it possibly look like for a small organization, for a medium organization, for a big organization? And then we're just going to have some like back and forth question and answer about like, what should we measure? What's good? What's bad? So absolutely think of this as kind of like an instructive Q&A. We wanted it to be like very workshoppy. And then at the close of CBC, I actually am going to be putting out some template equity scorecards that you can download if you want to use this as the basis for forming your own. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Roxanne for introduction.
Yeah, so is this mic on, or do I need to do something to it? Okay, great. So I am on an AHA representation to the Brewers Association Board of Directors. I've been on the BA Diversity Committee for about from the beginning, actually a couple months after, when Scott finally let me talk about it. But I also spent 31 years working at Procter & Gamble in R&D. And you know, obviously in a large company, scorecards are important. And my main experience with scorecards was in the safety realm. And in the safety realm, there are a lot of kind of similarities with what we need from an equity standpoint on how to think about them, how to measure things, watch outs, making sure you're measuring the right things, using the data correctly, as opposed to, like, you know, having a measure for something that's like you said, you put it up on the other other slide, and I can't remember. It's like I'll remember what you said on one of the other slides
in
the room. But it's like, you know, making sure you have the right measures and you're using those measures correctly. You know, this isn't just checkbox, right? This is making sure that you have something that is going to use you to help move forward, not just to satisfy a checklist.
Great. Thank you, Roxanne. So here's what we're going to do for the next until 1:55. We're going to talk about some core areas to include in your equity scorecard. That's going to be a very small group of areas. We're going to talk about setting goalposts and guardrails. That's the kind of framework I use for targets. So goalposts are things to shoot for. Guardrails are the things that keep you from falling off into the void. And so rather than saying, like, we got to do this, I like to set these outer boundaries with goalposts and guardrails. And then lastly, I'll talk a little bit about data collection and how you can use outside data to benchmark against and some things along those lines. So pretty simple. Again, hoping this just ends up being a lot of back and forth. So let's talk about core areas. If you stick with the metaphor that I started with, was that your equity scorecard is a report card, right? If you go back to like the days of school, assuming you went to a school that did report cards, some of them don't. But if you did one that had report cards, what you remember is like your report card did not have every grade for every assignment you ever did on it, right? Like it was an aggregate. And you just got a grade in a subject. So it was kind of like language arts or mathematics or handwriting from second grade. And so your equity scorecard is similar. It doesn't have a metric or something attached to every single thing you do in your organization. Just the really important things. And I think it's important to make sure that you have at least one metric on your scorecard in all of your kind of core areas of people practice. So these are five areas that I would say, if you're going to build an equity scorecard for your organization, I think you should have a metric, at least one metric, and in these five areas. Right? That could be a five-metric scorecard, right? Very compact, not too terribly difficult to deal with. The one that I work with for the BA has 23 metrics on it, and that's a pretty big one. So that just gives you some idea of scope. So what kind of metrics could you use in these core areas? So let's start with HR. Right? So I have this chart. Sorry that it's both small and wavy. We'll walk through it together. Small, medium, large, that really refers to like size of business and what sort of capacity you have to leverage for a project like this. I won't define small by like a number of employees, but I would say that if you don't have like dedicated HR function, if everybody has like four jobs, right, like that's small. Right. Medium is probably where you do start to have some dedicated HR, dedicated marketing, right? There's more like departmental structure within your organization. And large would really be right, like if you have definite like kind of structural differentiation within your organization, and you might even have like departments, that would be large. So if you are a small organization, I think some metrics that you can start thinking about on your scorecard would be recruitment and employee experience. I think those are two ones that are pretty easy to get a hold of without having a whole lot of extra dedicated staff to work on it. So recruitment, what do some recruitment KPIs look like? If you were in the session I did in this morning, I mentioned an example that was like this. For me, recruitment starts with pipeline. And so, and pipeline is about like who's applying for your jobs, not just who's getting them. And if you don't know who's applying for your jobs now, that's a great place to start. Figure out who it is who's applying. So this might be diverting people to an anonymous demographic survey when they complete their application. Or it could be some things that you do at the interview stage, but starting to get a hold of like who was applying. Right? This could be as easy as like aggregating the zip codes from your applications and then figuring out like, okay, these are the places people reside, because you can match up demographics to place if you go to the census and just look at census tract. So think about ways you can collect information about recruitment. The second is employee experience. How are people doing once they're in your organization? There are a lot of ways to kind of get a hold of employee experience, but one very, very popular and commonly accessible one is the Gallup Q12. That the Q12 is basically an employee engagement survey. It's 12 questions, and the cool thing that it's like benchmarked against millions of people who have taken the Q12 before. So very easy lift, really useful information, very good benchmark to work against. And it takes, like, you could just say, hey, y'all, we're going to take the Q12 half an hour, right? And it's done, right? You've done it for the year. Really useful tool. Those are two things that smaller organizations can do. If you move up to a larger organization, medium, I think adding advancement as a KPI is important. So that might be looking at your hiring and promotion processes, like who is advancing, or just taking a look at how your leadership group compares to the rest of the employee base. So one of the things that we noticed in our BIRDS Association employee benchmarks is that while in certain categories we have a decent amount of demographic diversity, it's not bleeding up to leadership. Right? It's all in service, usually public facing or service positions, or in entry-level packaging production positions. So adding advancement is a great way to think about, right, understanding how your organization is performing from an equity standpoint. And then lastly, large organizations, I would say some retention analysis would be a thing to add there too. So who's staying the longest and who is turning over and why? Things like exit surveys are really helpful there. And if you're HR department, they should be keeping track of who's separating anyway. So those are some ways to do that. So with these things on the table, what I'd love to do is pause and ask, one, if any of you are kind of keeping track of information in any of these, if you want to share how you do it or what you do, love to hear that. Or if you have any specific questions about how you might see this show up on a scorecard, we'd be happy to take those questions either. As well. Yeah, Culture Amp, and I'm just repeating this because I wanted to go into the mic. Employee engagement measured by Culture Amp. Do you have any just feedback about how you've been using that? Are you in an ownership position?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Quarterly sounds awfully frequent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, great. Great. So at the BRS Association, we use the Q12 for our employee engagement metric on our scorecard. And what we look at is the Q12 allows you to separate the scores by whatever demographic categories you ask for. So on our scorecard, we look at five key categories. We look at gender, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, disability status, and veteran status. And so essentially, it'll show us our Q12 scores broken out by all those groups. The cool thing is that Gallup will do this for you. You don't have to do it on your own. That's nice. And then, so what we have is a goalpost, which is we want everybody's scores to essentially be the same. Right? So, like, if we have, like, a really low Q12 mean, that sucks. But we want it to be low for everybody. Right? Our guardrail is if our Q12 mean is out of whack for one particular group by more than a, like, so the Q12 comes back to you on a 5-point scale, by more than half a point, then we call that our threshold for non-performance. That means we're not performing in an equitable way, and it means that, like, immediate action needs to be taken, right? So we have a goalpost that we want to hit. Confession, you probably don't ever hit them because they should be aspirational. And we have a guardrail, which is basically like, okay, it is actually harmful or potentially dangerous to our business if it persists under this threshold, right? So that could mean harm to people, harm to morale, right? Safety conditions. So those are goalposts and guardrails there. Okay, without any other questions, I'll move to the next area. No, I brought the clicker over here. There we go. Okay. So supplier and partner relationships. This one's a big one. And I think it's a big one because our industry is kind of behind the ball with regard to this. So when we talk about supplier and partner relationships, or you'll hear the term supplier diversity a lot, it has to do with, like, who you are using for your procurement and who you're making partnerships with. You may hear lots of things from, like, large organizations out there, like Nike, Facebook, like a lot of these big corporations have made concrete commitments to say, we're going to spend, you know, 25% of our procurement budget with companies that are owned by minority, female, veteran-owned, et cetera. And they have a pretty nice universe to work inside because a lot of those businesses are certified, right? They carry certification. So we're certified women-owned, et cetera. Our industry really does not have a lot of certification. Like, a lot of people haven't moved forward with that. So finding businesses that are either diversely owned or run or who have values aligned with you can actually just be difficult because we're in an industry sector where it's just not that common. So just wanted to put that caveat out there. So same thing here, small, medium, large. If you're small, I think values alignment is a really good way to think about it. And that idea is just, are our suppliers' values aligned with ours? Right. Lots of people do this in terms of, like, sustainability, right? Like, we want to get our coasters from a green, right, producers, or et cetera. So it's a similar thing, right? Like, we want to make sure that our organization has values-aligned suppliers. So one of the things I've seen organizations do is use surveys or things like professional comportment agreements when they work with suppliers. So it's basically like, we need you to sign that you will conduct yourself in this way, and if you don't, this grounds for termination of our relationship. I've heard things, I just had a great conversation with a brewery that uses, like, an intake survey before they agree to pour their beer at a festival. And they ask things like, is there a reporting system? Well, you know, will there be people with training on staff? Do you have ADA compliant menus? How are you providing water? Like, and they use that kind of value system to align with their, like, how they do business. The nice thing for this is that you basically can set goals like, we want to make sure that 20, 30, 40, 50% of our supplier relationships are values aligned. And if you use an intake form, it's really easy to say, like, this one is and this one's not, right? I think this is really important when it comes to, like, walking the walk in terms of how you show up. Great example, I worked with a client at one point that was doing some pride work. And they got some glassware printed that was, like, pride-themed. And somebody later kind of, I don't know how they snoothed it out, but, you know, the interweb, they will find out, found out that the printer they used for the glassware has a fairly, like, aggressive anti-LGBTQ stance, right? And so the idea is like, okay, well, if you're going to be showing up in that way, you really should make sure that your supplier relationships are values aligned.
And I think one of the things on this is, you know, when you're starting out, it may be hard to find, and you may have to set a somewhat lower goal than you might originally like to, you know, we need to be at least this. But once you get that, like, you know, okay, we've achieved this. Now we know better what we're doing. Let's increase our goals. Let's change those guardrails. So this is not something that once you set it, it is set in stone. You can change it. You can update it. Hopefully you're updating it on the going higher as opposed to going lower. But, you know, it's not like you do it now and you never touch it again and these are your guardrails for life.
Yeah, great. So medium organizations, right, I would say you now have the capacity to kind of do some investigation about the ownership of suppliers and partners. And then larger organizations may have the capacity to do outreach. So one of the things that I'm really looking to do is getting that certification issue cleaned up with our allied trade folks. And so, you know, the big idea I've got churning up here is, like, we need to get a certification program, right? Like, we need to help people who are like, hey, I'm a vet-owned business. I want to get certified, but that costs $500, and me and my wife run this company. And so, like, a larger organization can be like, well, we'll help you walk through the process, and we got $500 to get you certified, right? And that's a cool thing because that certification speaks to the whole community, not just you. So that's where we are, supplier-partner relationships. Anything any of you all doing that you want to share or any specific questions? Yeah. So one, way easier to do with new partners than existing partners, because they're going to be like, we never cared before. So acknowledge that. I want to kind of make that. With new folks, I would definitely say, like, it's part of our, like, intake, right? Like, it's part of, like, how we start talking to new suppliers. And absolutely, specific questions like, do you have a non-discrimination policy in your place of business, right, is a perfectly reasonable question to ask. There are clients I've worked with who are like, I'm feeling really anxious about asking these questions. And I showed them some things that people ask about, like, green practice. So people who are, like, surveying their potential suppliers for how green they are, how sustainable they are. And they get in the weeds, right? Like, they ask you, like, do you use CFL light bulbs? Like, do you have LED? Like, do you have low-capacity flush toilets? Like, they are asking very specific questions. And so I think we just have to kind of normalize asking, like, we want to work with folks who, you know, do particular things. I would say another great place to think about, like, what are practices that we want to ask people about. B Corp offers a really fantastic framework of just, like, ethical human practices, and you can look at some of the categories that B Corp certifies on. I think it's a great tool to use to create your own like supplier intake thing. I would say with maybe being reticent with people you have existing supplier relationships with, I would say like if you can have a really open and candid conversation and say, we're trying to learn more about our suppliers, you know, can we ask you a couple of questions? And maybe that becomes a really great point of like building a better relationship with your existing suppliers. Because the cool thing is like you learn those things about each other, you become each other's like advocates, right? Like then you get to talk to somebody else and be like, oh, you know, we work with this person and they do this, you know. So again, kind of an all ships rise situation there. I'm going to dig through my stuff and see if I have any sample intakes for just values alignment. I can put those with the templates when we circulate afterward. Yeah, and honestly, just some, to dovetail on something Finn just said, using RFPs. Right, like we're a business of like, who's your person? Okay, cool, I'll call them, you know? Like, you need a t-shirt? Like everybody just immediately is like, okay, call Grandstand. You know what I mean? Like we don't do a lot of like open, you know, calls for proposals and things along those lines. And like using even a semi-structured RFP process would probably make some of this a lot easier as well. Awesome. Thanks for the question, too. Communications is the next area. So small organizations. I actually think internal updates. A lot of people, as soon as they hear communications, they think out, right? Communicating outward. I actually think communicating internally to your team is really important, especially about issues like this. So when I say internal communications, I really mean talking to your team about how you're doing from an equity standpoint in the organization. Right? And that idea is like if you have an equity scorecard, sharing the results with them, right? That can be like, did we do it? Did we share it? Yes, no, right? And sometimes, and, you know, a lot of people think about these metrics, these KPIs, and they think they have to be like complicated measures. Yes, no, did we do it? Did we not do it? Is a really effective KPI. And so like this metric could literally be like, have we communicated with our staff, right, this year about our DEI goals and how we're progressing, right? And that's a pretty simple way to go. I think if you're even a small to medium-sized organization, imagery audits are a really good idea. An imagery audit just looks at like labels, social media, posters, t-shirts, whatever you do that has an image on it. If those images have people or places, getting a group of people together in an audit committee and saying, okay, what are we putting out in the world? In one of the talks that I give frequently to state guilds, I take this moment and pause and I ask everybody to take out their phone and look at their brewery's social media. And I have them, you know, do a little whip through the IG or whatever they have. And I ask, like, okay, if your phone is a mirror, who's looking in the mirror? Right? Is it a lot of people or is it like the photogenic person in your production room, right? Who like, because that's kind of what folks do. And a lot of people, like, when from up here, I look at the faces, people are like, right? Like they don't even realize, right, like what they have been doing in the images they're putting out in the world. So I think periodic imagery audit is a really great way to kind of be like, check yourself and be like, are we communicating how we think we're communicating? When I do imagery audits, one of the things I look for is who's there, right? Very visible thing, but like we also know dimensions of diversity are not always visible. So I also look at environments and situations. So like what's happening and where, right? You'd be shocked how many people are like, that beer's not for me because every image the beer's in, there's like a mountain stream or something. And they're like, I don't live near mountain streams. I'm not resonating with that. Right? So like situationally. And then I always look at power. So, like, if you have 100 pictures and 5 of the pictures have somebody pouring a beer for somebody else, but the person pouring the beer is always female. That's a power problem, right? So, like, think about, like, how scenarios and situations are being portrayed in your imagery. Lastly, I would say communications you can add would be thinking about platforms for underrepresented marginalized groups. So are you speaking in ways or to folks that you don't often speak to? And that's really interesting. Heather, who's not here with us today, she's from Maine. And a lot of Mainers are like, there's not a lot of different people in Maine, you know. But if you've been to Portland, Maine, anybody been to Portland? There is a pretty large African immigrant community in Maine, specifically in Portland. And so a lot of the folks that I've talked to up there have realized that they have to maybe, like, advertise in publications that are non-English publications. So they might have to get somebody to translate and then place something there. But finding your way to, like, speak on platforms or other publications that are not usually your own. This might be like working with an influencer who has a different a different base than you do, forming some different relationships, but like finding ways to communicate not only through your own thing. As an industry, we are bad at this. Like, when I talk to people, like, what have you tried? And they're like, well, we, and I'm like, well, let's stop there, right? Because, like, we do too much in our own bubble, and breaking out of the bubble is pretty important. Anything to add?
Don't use Google Translate. I mean, really, it's critical if you are going to try and do something like that to get someone who speaks the language as a first language and that they translate and back translate and, you need to make sure that it makes sense in the language you're trying to communicate in, because there's syntax, there's context, and mm-hmm. everything is crazy, especially when you're starting to go to languages that are imagery, circular kind of type of stuff based. If you're going to an Asian language and you're trying to do like a word-for-word translation, I guarantee you're going to screw it up.
Mm-hmm.
So
any questions, hacks, tips you want to share? I'll give you one quick story. I think they're up in Chicago. I don't remember the name of the brewery now, but they decided that they wanted to start offering tours for the deaf community because they were like, tours are kind of fun, and I think this is like a lift we can make. And so they just called up a local school for folks who are training to be simultaneous translators and simultaneous interpreter. And they were like, do you want to come give brewery tours? It would give you an opportunity to, like, practice. We'll pay you to do it, you know. And so through that tour, they got somebody who, like, wanted some real-life experience, and they were, like, super excited to learn about the tour. They started offering them once a month, and what they realized was, it was not just members of the deaf community. It was members of people who were learning American Sign Language and just wanted another learning experience. And then it just became like the hangout. So it was the same people came on the tour every month, but they'd be like, no, we're going to do this ASL tour. It's dope. And like, it actually became like a really popular event for them. So now they have like brewery merch that has like hand signs that like spells the name of their brewery. It's just become like a whole organic connection to community that they made, and it really started with being like, okay, we want to do some communications, and we are going to take our hands off of it, and it ended up going really positively. So, and then I would say, right, this is our last big area: harassment, discrimination, and violence permission. Absolute must. That first metric for small organizations, ongoing training and learning, are you doing it? Right. And the way that we frame it at the Brewers Association, our guardrail is 80% of the staff has to go through at least annual non-discrimination harassment prevention training. Our goalpost, what we're shooting for, 100%. 100% of the staff does it at least once a year. Right now, we're at 100% twice a year, so we're doing great. Incident reporting would be their second place. We also use this internally at the BA. For us, it's number of incidents. So our goalpost, we want to have zero incidents every year. Right? Our guardrail is two or more. If you have two or more reported incidents in a 12-month period, again, it triggers a state of immediate action. So something has to be done immediately. And then lastly, onboarding outcomes is something we add. And that's basically like, once people onboard, do they feel confident that they are in an environment where they will be free from these types of things? And those are usually like essentially 30, 60, 90 day, right, like type of once your onboarding is completed type moments. Right? I think of these as like non-negotiables. It's kind of like you kind of have to do this. Even if you don't have a scorecard, you have to do this. You know, we've all been here for the last year in this industry, and we kind of know what the consequences are of not doing it. So
I just want to add here that it's really important to not have like reporting an incident be a negative, particularly for the person who is reporting it, right? So it's one of those things, and I relate this to some of the safety stuff that we did, is like, you know, you don't want to have the person slammed because they reported something, oh, now you screwed up our numbers. So it's really important to have it to be a safe way. One of the ways that you can also do that is look at like positive, you know, have people report positive behaviors too. Hey, so-and-so in the tap room stood up to this person who was harassing one of the servers. You know, so you can add positive types of things to that. So it makes it so that you're not just reporting negative behavior, but you're also reporting positive behavior. And when you do that, hopefully you get the broader picture too. And it gives you an idea of where things are going right and where things aren't going right. You know, is it customers? Is it internal? You know, what is it when you look at it that? But it's really critical to take it into an area where people feel comfortable reporting an issue if there is one. But you're also finding out about good behaviors, because that helps set the rest of your culture when it comes to DEI stuff. If you have a culture of people who are reporting positively helping others when it comes to this stuff, that's something you need to know too, and maybe becomes like one of your, maybe that becomes something that you say, hey, we need to add a measure on this also to our scorecard in the future as you work to refine it.
Great. Events products. So small organizations, I think product labels, people get themselves in trouble with labels. So I would just say that finding a way to quantify label review is a really nice process. So I've seen breweries who do label review internally, so they just allow a broader group of their colleagues to look at art before it goes out, or beer names before they go out. Some people let that go externally if they have like a loyalty club at the brewery, like a mug club or something. They might be like, hey, we want to, you know, give you first look at some art. And it's really like, you know, it's like a book cover reveal for those folks. They're like, sweet. But you use it as a way to kind of get feedback and to troubleshoot, see if there's any issues with your labels. For medium organizations, I would say events are another space you can start thinking about looking at some key performance indicators, specifically volunteers. We do so much reliance and utilization of volunteers in our industry events, and those are people who are not being compensated, and we don't give them any tools for dealing with misconduct. So I happen to be the president of the board of directors at Safe Bars. We have Amy here doing a workshop. And Safe Bars offers training for industry events for volunteers specifically, so that the people who are going to pour your beer have some de-escalation strategies, know what to do if they see somebody doing misconduct, know what to do with people who are over-consuming, right? Because usually we're like, 2 ounces, have fun, you know. So getting your events a little bit more buttoned up is a great way to go. And then lastly, stakeholder feedback. So like creating some formalized feedback loops about your events, your products, your spaces with the people in your community. And when I say stakeholders, I do mean the people in your community. not just investors. They're important, but probably your community is a little bit more important.
And just one quick thing to add on events. Some states have laws that it must be at like a beer festival, the servers have to be volunteers. They can't be employees. So, you know, that becomes, you know, important for your brewery to think about that and to potentially, you know, work with the event organizer on that. Ohio is one of those states. They don't care that you have people who are trained to serve beer and look at those things. It must be a volunteer. And because you're an employee and, you know, you're not allowed because if you're an employee, then you have to be paid. So it's like this circular stuff, but you have to look at things for, you know, how does it affect me as a brewery? And my people.
Awesome. So we said a little bit about it thus far, goalposts and guardrails, but just giving you some guidelines here. Just those goalposts, I call that the threshold for success. So it should be aspirational, but it should be actually achievable. So if it's too far out of reach, you're never going to take it seriously. But if it's too easy, then you've let yourself off the hook. So aspirational, but achievable. And the way that you kind of have a discussion of what does success mean, right? Sit with the question, right? What does it look like, feel like, sound like, right? What is it like when our DEI efforts have been successful, right? When we've done what we want, like what we think we want to do, what is this place going to be like? That is what the success state looks like. So for me at the Brewers Association, it means that like when we look at the demographics of people who are speakers at CBC, or who are judges at World Beer Cup, or who are applicants for the jobs that we have open, it looks like the United States, right? It looks like the demographics of our whole country because we are a trade association that serves the whole country. So I set a lot of our benchmarks against national census data. Right. So if 13% of Americans are black, I want 13% of CBC speakers to be black. Right. That's just how I'm setting success because I think we can do it. Do we have a long way to go? Oh, yeah, we do. Right. But those are the thresholds I'm setting. Threshold for non-performance, that's your guardrail. Okay. That, again, is a state to where if you fall beneath that threshold, it poses a threat to the health and well-being of your people and your business, right? Because you're at risk for lawsuits, right? You're at risk for misconduct. You're at risk for unusually high turnover, right? All of these things are risks for your people and for your business, okay? So when you hit this threshold, right, it should trigger immediate action. So we have to have a meeting. We have to decide what we're going to do. And it becomes a priority working on that until you get your next scorecard. Lastly, that looks wild. I will talk to you a little bit about using census data to benchmark demographics. This is primarily how I do it, but not always. The census data can feel like real out of control until you get in there. But there are some basic guidelines that I think are really important. All census data is available to everybody. So the easiest way to kind of get into it is to go to data.census.gov. And then they actually have, that'll give you the search screen. And then you can look at advanced search from there, and that will allow you to kind of push buttons until you figure out what you want, right? What I like to do is first do geography, right? If you are a tap room in Wisconsin, you don't need to look at national demographics. You might need to look at your county or your city or your census block, right? You can create geographies as big or as small as you want. So good example, for the Brewers Association, when we look at our job applicants, we look at the demographics of the Boulder-Denver metro area. We don't go any broader because that's where most of our employees are going to come from, right? But when we look at the metrics for World Beer Cup judges, we use the whole country because our judges come from all over the country, right? So think about your geography first, what's realistic there. And I would say the first thing you should do is just output that like American facts survey thing for that geography. It will just tell you the basics. Gender, age, race, income, educational attainment, household size, all those basics. But that's so powerful to look at because you're like, this is who's here, right? Like, this, these are the folks who say they're here. And people are commonly surprised when they look at who's in their neighborhood, right? And they're like, I didn't know these people are here because they're not walking in my door, right? So I would say, first thing, just get familiar with your area. And then use the search tools that are in there to kind of drill down on what categories you want to find out. It takes a lot of, like, fiddling, but eventually you'll get to what you want. I'm probably going to be putting together a collab hour presentation on how to do some basic census cuts, because a lot of people have asked. But I think just getting in, starting, like, poke around is a really good place to start. The BRRRS Association has some data sets that you can use as well. So we have some demographics of, like, craft beer drinkers. So, like, what are the demographics of craft beer drinkers across the country and in some specific metropolitan areas? And we also have some benchmarking data on who is existing in the industry. So I told you before that we want our speakers and our judges to be more or less representative of the whole United States. That's our goalpost. Our guardrail is we want our speakers and judges to be at least as diverse as the industry is, right? Which is not very diverse, but we want to at least hit that. Like, if we're not even doing representing who's already here, then that's a really bad job. So that guardrail, we use our benchmarking data that we collected about the demographics of the people who work in our industry. So your goalpost and guardrail might use different sets, if that makes sense, if you're doing demography. Census is a great tool, and there's a couple others you can look around. I would say if you're a small organization, stay away from demographics like this, because it takes time to go through. So think about other KPIs that are a little bit more about, like, the actions you took. Did you do the action or did you not? And that'll keep it less wieldy for smaller groups of people. Some closing thoughts. Make sure if you do a scorecard, you think about utilization, frequency, and audience. How is it going to be tied into what you're doing? For us, it's really about, like, does action need to be taken? Right? That's our kind of big thing. Some people tie this into reward systems, though. So they say, like, you hit success on all your scorecard measures, we get a bonus, or we get a whatever, right? Like, so think of how is it built in. Frequency, how often are you going to do it? We do ours biannually, so we have a spring scorecard and a fall scorecard. I would say once a year is probably adequate, but probably should be at least once a year. And then audience, who gets it? It could be, this is just for the leadership group. This could be, this is for all employees. This could be, this is for all our members. Some people go, like, full transparency and say, we're putting this on our website. Right? We want everybody to know, because this is how we're holding ourselves accountable. So have a decision about who's getting it. So we actually are totally out of time. Yeah, because I have to go over there and talk on that mic in a moment. What I'd love to do again is just invite you to email if you have questions, drj@brrrrsassociation.org, or get in touch with me or any of the members of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee at the BRRRS Association or its subcommittees. We've got a couple of those folks in the house right now. Fenwick, Trey, Pam are all in the committee, Roxanne. So these are great people to have conversations with if you'd like. And again, this is going to be an ongoing conversation for us. Started at last CBC, brought it back here, but I think it's going to be something we bring through collab hours that will be at CBC next year. And, you know, big, hairy, audacious goal, we'd love to create, like, our own industries benchmarks for an industry scorecard so that if you have a certain metric you decide to measure, we can all, just like our sustainability benchmarking project, you can upload your data, we'll aggregate it, and then you can be like, how am I doing in comparison to other breweries my size or in my state? So long-term project, but I think it would be great for our industry to do it. And excited that you all are here. Thank you, and hope we can help you move forward on this.
Yeah. That's so funny. I used to deal with census data, but